Okay, I want to describe some work that I've been doing recently with Oyvind Taffert and Neil Constable. And the idea is that, in our explorations of the physics of D-brains, we've discovered many remarkable dualities, which are basically situations where we have two distinct mathematical frameworks which allow us to describe the same physical systems. And so many of those have been well studied. One of the dualities, the one I have in mind today, there's been less emphasis put on, is the ability to describe certain D-brain configurations from the point of view of two distinct world volume theories. And so the example that I have in mind that's commonly discussed is the case of D1 brains intersecting with or ending on D3 brains. And so from the point of view of the D3 brain world volume theory, the D strings or the D1 brains arise as magnetic monopoles in the UN3 or the UN gauge theory that appears on the world volume there. But you can also think about this system from the point of view of the D-string world volume theory, and there what you find is that the D3 brains appear as non-commutative geometries from the point of view of UN scalar field theory that lives on the strings. So in my talk today, I'm going to review that duality, or those two world volume theories describing this system, but I also want to describe our steps towards extending those kinds of ideas to thinking about the D1s ending on D5 brains. And what we'll find is that there's a very similar story in that situation. However, the D1s ending on D5s, that's not an intersection that's commonly discussed. And so some of us may be asking, well, can D1s really end on D5s? And so I thought that I should start with some general discussion of D-brain intersections here. And so here I'm going to just focus on the simplest geometry, and it's the same geometry that I'm going to focus on throughout this talk. So I've got some kind of planar D-brain of large dimensions, and then a semi-infinite, or a collection of semi-infinite D-strings extending off to infinity. Now, those D-strings are sources for the Ramond-Ramond 3 form, and so there's some supergravity equation for the Ramond-Ramond 3 form, and if I integrate that, if I take the flux, or the electric flux of 3 form around some 7 sphere that surrounds the D-string, I get the charge enclosed, namely, which counts the number of D-strings. And I can shift that 7 sphere up and down, and because of these equations of motion, that charge is conserved. However, if I move the sphere off to the left, of course, the net flux out here is going, on this side of my big brain, is going to drop to zero, and so the charge isn't conserved anymore. But, of course, the explanation of that is that I've passed the 7 sphere through my larger D brain, and that D brain adds an extra source term to the equations of motion. If I look at the Wessamino term in the world volume theory here, I find that there's a coupling to the appropriate Ramond-Ramond 2 form that we're interested in here. And it's a coupling to the appropriate, well, through the, sorry, through the world volume gauge fields. And so if I'm talking about a dn plus 1 brain, there are n factors of the gauge field strength. Or in other words, I'm coupling to the nth Chern class on the world volume there. And so that modifies then my equation of motion. And my integral then over the 7 sphere has two contributions, one coming from the strings, one coming from a possible intersection with the larger dn plus 1 brain. And so as I pass through, the charge can drop to zero because of this extra contribution coming from the intersection. And so to make that explicit by sticking in some specific numbers or considering some explicit values of n. If n is 1, what I'm talking about is D strings ending on the D3 brains. And what the D strings do is they act as a source for magnetic charge on the world volume of the D3 brains, or for first Turing class. If n equals 2, then I'm talking about the D5 brain, which will be the case of interest later. And in there, what I'm doing, or the D strings are doing, is they're acting as a source for instanton number, or second Turing class. Now, the instanton number is inherently a non-abelian, or is going to involve non-abelian gauge fields. And so perhaps one of the reasons that it's not commonly considered this intersection is that I'm talking about multiple D5 brains. I can't end on an individual D5 brain. The other reason is, of course, that the D1, D5 system is not going to be supersymmetric in contrast to the previous situation. So there's less control over the world volume theories or over that particular set of configurations. Okay, so let's start with a recap then of the D3, D1 system. And so we can start by thinking about D3 brains growing into D strings. How do we view it from the D3 brain world volume theory? There I'm going to think about a single D3 brain in flat space. Then the world volume theory is just the Born-Infeld action. I've got a gauge field that lives in this four-dimensional world volume and a bunch of transverse scalars. These are all U1 fields because I'm thinking about the abelian theory. For simplicity, I can just look at the leading order terms in the expansion. And if I focus on that part of the action, I've just got a free Maxwell field and a bunch of free scalars. And so the leading order equations are very familiar. They're very simple. Just the ordinary Maxwell equations and Laplace's equation for the scalars. Of course, there's some simple solutions, namely magnetic monopoles here. And some, if I choose, say, one of the scalars, the phi 9, that can take some, have some spherically symmetric configuration. I'll call that suggestively for later purposes, I'll call that profile sigma of r that just goes like 1 over r. Those are simple, or those are independent solutions here of those leading order equations. I can also, though, ask about supersymmetry. I can impose that my configuration be supersymmetric, which actually requires that the scalar and the field strength satisfy an equation given here. What that does is it fixes the coefficient for my scalar profile in terms of the magnetic charge. But the other thing that it does is it also guarantees that these solutions of the leading order equation, in fact, are solutions of the full Born-Infeld theory. So if I take my supersymmetric configuration, one of the things I might ask is, well, what's the energy of that configuration? And so I can evaluate the energy that involves this action, and that square root for this particular configuration simplifies. The quantity in the determinant is actually a perfect square, and so I get an energy that's the sum of two parts. If I actually evaluate that then with the profile that I've given here, I get two terms. One of which I can interpret as just the energy associated with the three brains filling this three plane. But then the other, coming from this term involving the scalar and field strength, I can associate with the energy of a semi-infinite set of D strings extending off to infinity. And so what we have in this picture then is the world volume being deformed by the excitation of this transverse scalar, and it grows a spike which extends off to infinity. That profile, when I stick in all of the factors of string scale and pi's and everything, at the end of the day takes this form, which we'll use for comparison purposes later, or alternatively I can switch it and think of the radius as a function of sigma, the distance away from the brain. If we then look at the world volume theory on the D strings, here what I've got is a collection of D strings. And so I've got a non-abelian gauge or gauge symmetry there. And so the action is somewhat more complicated. It involves a bunch of scalar fields in the adjoint of UN. But once again, I can just look at the leading order terms in that action, and there's a kinetic term and then a potential term for these scalars. I can look at the equations of motion, and now rather than Laplace's equation, on the other side, I've got some commutator terms. To look for solutions, I'm going to take a simple ansatz where some of the scalars have this form, where there's a fixed matrix, and then there's a non-trivial profile. I'm going to look for static solutions, and so the profile is going to depend on the position along the string. And then C is just some normalization constant that I'm going to choose so that this radial profile actually corresponds to what I think of as the radius of this configuration when I excite the transverse scalars. For the present purposes, I'm going to choose these matrices here to be an n by n irreducible representation of SU2, in which case I choose the normalization constant as given over there, n squared minus 1. If I plug that in, then I get some second order equation in terms of R, and it has lots of solutions. I'm going to focus my attention on a particular class of solutions by also imposing the supersymmetry condition, which is more restrictive or confines us to by imposing a first order equation that says that the derivative is proportional to the commutator of the scalars. Once again, what that does is it ensures that these solutions of the leading order equations actually are solutions of the full Born-Infeld theory. The other thing I can do is I can see in that supersymmetry condition actually Naum's equations. And so what this is doing, what this is doing is it's giving us a physical realization then of the Naum transform of the moduli space of BPS monopoles that we saw in the world volume theory of the D3 brains. A simple set of solutions, then, to this equations for the radial profile takes this form of some coefficient over sigma, which is now the distance along the string. And if I compare to the result I had on the previous transparency, in fact, it's the same up to a small correction, at least at large n. That profile was identical except for that last factor of 1 minus 1 over n squared. And so the radius then begins very small at large sigma, and it grows and opens up into a three-plane at sigma equals 0. We can anticipate that there's no favored direction, and so this is spherically symmetric in that three-plane, and so that the cross-sections are some discrete approximation to a two-sphere, or in other words, this matrix configuration actually describes a fuzzy two-sphere. And so that kind of geometry, where I've got an expanding non-commutative geometry, is what are the fuzzy funnels of the title of my talk. I can take this matrix configuration and again ask about the energy of this system. Things simplify again, and it reduces to a simple sum of two terms. There's a term involving the energy of my D strings extending off to infinity, and then another term that I can associate with the energy of the D3 brains that are going to fill this three plane when the funnel opens up. You can also confirm that what it's opening up into is really a D3 brain by asking about the couplings to the appropriate Ramond-Ramond charge. A three brain should couple to the four-form Ramond-Ramond potential. And if you look at the Wessamino term in the D-string world volume theory, there's an appropriate coupling. And if you go through a calculation, what you find is that there's a coupling in the appropriate way to the components of the four-form potential with indices time and in the three-plane where the funnel is opening up. And so what we found then is that up to small corrections of 1 over n squared that appear in various places here, here, and here, these two descriptions in the D-string world volume theory and in the D3 world volume theory actually give us this, or are describing the same physical configuration. But the Born-Infeld action that I'm writing down here and in the previous case for the abelian theory on the D3 world volume, on the one hand, they sum an infinite class of alpha prime corrections to some leading order low energy action, but they don't include all of the higher order corrections, and so they don't constitute the complete low energy theory. And so you might ask, why do we get such good agreement between these two sets of calculations? The D3 brain, in the D3 brain theory, you know that there are higher derivative corrections, and so you may think that the calculations are only valid at large radii where the fields are slowly varying. Similarly, the D1 brain theory, you know, as well as higher derivative corrections, there are various commutator corrections or ambiguities in the prescription of that action. And so you might think that it's only valid, the calculations there are only valid for small, when the funnel has a small radius, or when we're very far away from the D3 brain. If you think about what small radius and large radius mean in more detail, though, what you find on the D3 brain side is that the radius has to be much larger than the string scale, which for the profile that we were talking about means that the distance away from the 3-plane here must actually be much less than n, the number of D strings, times the string scale. So this is a much, larger limit than just string scale. On the other side, to avoid contributions from commutator corrections, what you find is that the radius must be much less than the square root of n times string scale, or that sigma must be much larger than square root of n times string scale. And so as a result, there's a large overlap between the two regimes where each of the theories should be giving us reliable results. And so that's why we can expect that each theory or that the results of the two calculations agree so well, at least when n is large. Okay, well, that's the D1, D3 brain system. Now we'd like to go on to think about other fuzzy funnels or similar fuzzy surfaces. We're always going to be thinking, or I'm going to be thinking about a similar ansatz for my scalar field. I'm going to have some radial profile and then some fixed matrices, and those matrices are going to determine what kind of geometry the funnel is opening up into. There's a puzzle here, though, in that if I do the same thing I did before and look at the leading order equations of motion, well, those equations are unchanged. The only thing I'm going to change is the geometry here, or that set of matrices. And so if I look at the differential equation that's going to come from here, it's always going to take this form of a second derivative of r being equal to up to some constant, the radius cubed. And so that's always going to have the solution that the radius depends or is inversely proportional to sigma, or in other words, sigma is inversely proportional to r. On the other hand, if I'm thinking about the D strings opening up into a DP brain, at large radius, then, sigma is going to be given by one of the transverse scalars in the world volume theory of that DP brain, and it should solve Laplace's equation. And that solution then, or that harmonic function, is going to drop off much more quickly than 1 over r. It's in fact, for a DP brain, it should drop off as 1 over r to the p minus 2. For p equals 3, these two happen to coincide, but for general p, this is actually dropping off much too slowly to be correct for this alternate DP brain world volume picture. You can anticipate, though, what the result or how that puzzle gets resolved, and that's simply that Well, the leading order equations, which are valid for small r, are going to dictate that there's some kind of universal behavior of all these funnels when the radius of the funnel is very small. However, when the radius gets large, then there are going to be a lot of higher order terms in the Born-Feld equations of motion or in the Born-Infeld action that are going to become important. And so by studying the full solution of the solutions of the full equations of motion, what's going to happen is at large radius, it'll reproduce some kind of fall off that's appropriate for a DP brain. And so we can take away from that, though, that this is a warning that just studying the leading order equations of motion isn't going to be sufficient, that in fact, for opening up into a D5 brain, we're going to have to think about the full equations of motion. Well, okay, we'll start with the D strings opening up into or growing into a D5 brain. In that case, the cross-section of our fuzzy funnel should be some discrete approximation of a four-sphere. And so our ansatz is going to take this form of a radial profile, some normalization constant, and then an appropriately chosen set of matrices. And we can find those matrices in the literature. In this study of non-commutative field theory on the four-sphere, or this matrix theory description of longitudinal five brains. And basically, these generators, the GIs, involve five-dimensional Dirac matrices. And you take to build larger representations, we take a tensor product of the matrices with n-unit matrices, and then we completely symmetrize that tensor product. The resulting dimension of the matrices here then, which gives us the number of D strings, is given by this equation here, where little n is the number of elements in that tensor product before we symmetrize the indices. We choose the normalization constant here in the same way that we did before. It's associated to what we might call the Casimir of these matrices. So C squared is roughly, for large n, proportional to little n squared. And that ensures then that the radial profile corresponds to what we would call the physical radius of our funnel. What Castellano and all showed is that these GIs satisfy a certain set of appropriate conditions that physically it looks like a four-sphere. And I'll just list them there. And one of the important ones will be that, in fact, it couples, our funnel couples in the appropriate way to the D5 brain charge. And it's also spherically symmetric. So we think that's our ansatz. We want to think about the same Born-Infeld, the non-abelian Born-Infeld action we had before, except that we want to look at the full equations of motion. Those full equations of motion are some really long expression. What we do is we plug in our ansatz, and we get a relatively simple expression here that says this quantity in brackets has to be a constant. What we do is we choose that integration constant in an appropriate way to describe an infinite funnel. And what we find if we massage this expression is that dr by d sigma, the distance along the string, is given by this square root. And you can explicitly solve for sigma of r in terms of elliptic integrals. But it's more useful just to look at this in various limits. And so one limit we might consider is when r is very small, way down the funnel, then the first term is the dominant term, and the derivative of r is proportional to r squared. What we find then is we get this desired, or I discussed before, this universal behavior where the radius is inversely proportional to the distance along the string. However, if we go to large r, it's the r to the eighth term that dominates. And so we get that the derivative is proportional to r to the fourth, which in fact then produces the desired fall off that sigma goes like 1 over r cubed, which looks like the harmonic functions in a five-dimensional space. The transition between these two is given at some distance out here that's given by the string scale times some large coefficient when n is large. You can verify various things, for example, the coupling to the appropriate Ramon-Ramon potential. In doing that calculation, what we find is there's a coupling, an expected coupling to the Ramon-Ramon 6 form times some dimensionless number, which then must be the number of five brains appearing in the five plane where the funnel opens up. For large n, it turns out that the number of five brains then is roughly given by this integer little n that appeared in our construction of the generators. And so in the previous case, I had a large number of D strings, but a single D3 brain. Here I've got a large number of D strings, but also a large number of five brains. And there's this curious relation between the numbers of each of those constituents. If I look at the energy, things simplify, but not in quite the same way. In fact, now I get a sum of several terms, one being the energy associated with the D strings extending away from the five brains. There's an energy that I can associate with the five brains filling the plane or the hyperplane there. But then there's also a term that looks like the energy of a bunch of D strings extending off radially through the five brains. There's not quite that much energy, though. There's a small deficit, which we'll call the binding energy, and it's again given by some large coefficient times some string scale quantity, and this 1.01 is just some numerical integral that one does. It's some dimensionless integral that's left over to do. Here, the fact that I'm not just getting the sum of two terms is a reflection of the fact that the system isn't supersymmetric, and so the energy just isn't just the energy of the individual constituents that went into the system. Rather, there's this extra term, or these extra terms here. There's a similar story that you can have for the D5 brains growing D1 brain spikes that's somewhat more involved. Remember that the D strings in that case were acting as a source for the second Chern class. And so there's going to be some non-abelian gauge fields involved. I also want to grow a spike, and so there's going to be a U1 or an abelian scalar involved. And in that case, the appropriate action takes this form here. You go through, we introduce a spherically symmetric or roughly spherically symmetric ansatz. The scalar field only depends on radius in the five brain world volume. The only components of the gauge field are going to be involving the angles on the four spheres in our polar coordinates here. You go through the equations of motion, and what you find is that the gauge field has to be self-dual, or you can find a solution if the gauge field is self-dual on the four sphere. But for consistency, we also have to assume that it's homogeneous, or that the second Chern class is evenly distributed around the four sphere. And in that case, what we find for the scalar is an equation that takes this form here. Or if I invert that to have dr by d sigma, I get, in fact, the same equation up to small corrections with a r to the fourth and an r to the eighth contribution. And you can check the energy as well, and you get the same expressions, again, up to small corrections for large n. So I'm going to run out of time, so I'll just put up. Once again, we found that there is a remarkable agreement between these two theories. You can ask a number of questions, or there are a number of comments. One is, should you have expected this agreement, or is there a region where both sets of calculations should give us reliable results? And the answer to that is yes. And then there's a number of other comments and questions that I'll leave unstated, but you can read them during the question period, I guess.
Any questions?
Rob, in the D1, D5 system, do you see, when you look at it from the five brain point of view, do you see any sign of special values or special connections between the number of D1 brains and D5 brains, like you see in the D1 system?
No. Okay, so point number five here is we had this curious relation between the number of D strings and the number of five brains. And so in the discussion I made so far, there's no indication of how that would arise in the D5 brain world volume theory. On the other hand, I actually cheated in that I didn't quite solve the system there. I just assumed that there was a spherically symmetric instanton configuration. In fact, in general, you shouldn't expect that you can find spherically symmetric instantons on the four-sphere. And so my conjecture would be that that relation between what is the rank of the gauge group and the instanton number is a restriction on when you can find these spherically symmetric configurations. But that's just a conjecture. We haven't fixed that at all.
Anyone else? There are no more questions. Let's thank the speaker.